Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue moving forward, I just got to remind you to keep learning, praying, and acting on a daily basis. Hopefully you're joining, or at least if you're interested and you kind of have a predilection towards, you know, group prayer and so forth, by all means, feel free. Just let us know if you're hosting a prayer, and we will, and it's open for the public, then we will let people know how to connect with you. So anyway, and you know, Tammy, I noticed that that's an opportunity for somebody to actually start using, you know, me as a network. And I find it interesting that I haven't had anybody do that, you know, call me up and, or, you know, reach out to me and say, hey, we're having this prayer group, so that when people start calling, they're really using it for another purpose, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's never happened, though. So that speaks to the quality of the character of those people who listen and we're working with. So anyway, let me just wrap up. The debt is fraud. Continue to learn, pray, and act. And folks, it is all about compliance to the Constitution. They are legally bound to do this. This is a legal obligation. They must support that Constitution, and it's clarified that if they don't in Section 3 and what it means to support, so therefore Section 3 basically is the teeth to remove them if they're not doing it. So all we have to really start doing is demanding that they enforce Section 3, because Section 3 says that they can't just look the other way when politicians are doing things they have no authority to do. They're to grab them by the scruff of their neck and throw them out immediately. No due process, none of that. Anyway, but any lawyer will walk up and say, well, that's not so. And they will try to argue otherwise. But the supreme law basically says this is not about a crime. This is about your eligibility. If you have violated your oath and you've done something that was not in support of the Constitution, you're gone. You don't need to have a trial. You don't need to defend yourself. Everybody saw what you did, and you're gone for that. And that is a game changer. And we've had it on the book since 1868. Well, it's about time we start using that thing, you know? Anyway, so we're in the Virginia ratification debates. And right now, we are in June 11th, this is the last comment by anti-federalist Mr. Grayson. I want to point this out because, you know, he happens to be, you know, really, he voted against the Constitution. He was trying to create arguments, but in all honesty, what he was doing was he was trying to understand the complexity of the Constitution. Most people think that they understood this form of republican government. Now, the republican form of government that Montesquieu wrote about was it was singular. There was no competition. It was one representative body. Now we're actually creating multiple representative bodies throughout the republic. And not only that, but actually in the application of the U.S. Constitution, and what I mean by that is the U.S. Constitution formed and stipulated how the federal government had to behave, act, and operate. Its roles, responsibilities, its standards, all of that. And so it applied to the federal government. And you've heard me say this, that the Constitution was the exemplar of government because of the checks and balances, and I don't want to say the complex nature of the Constitution, because it's really not that complex. But you have to understand how to break out this representative government with bicameral representation and so forth. But to me, I think we've, in this day, I think we're able to articulate this very well. Back in those days, this was brand new ground. And Mr. Grayson is kind of questioning and rubbing his head. How can we have two sovereigns? And it becomes a contradiction, you know, in the scope. And so as we kind of talk about this, because they will actually answer the question, but let's go ahead and dive into his seeking clarity on this. So go ahead.
Okay. As to direct taxation, make sure I'm unmuted. As to direct taxation, give up this and you give up everything, as it is the highest act of sovereignty. Surrender up this inestimable jewel and you throw away a pearl richer than all your tribe. But it has been said by an honorable gentleman, Mr. Pendleton, as well as I recollect, that there could be no such thing as an interference between the two legislatures, either in point of direct taxation or in any other case whatsoever. An honorable gentleman, Mr. Mason, has replied that they might interfere in the case of a poll tax. I will go farther and say that the case may happen in the judiciary. Suppose a state execution and a federal execution issued against the same man, and the state officer and federal officer seize him at the same moment, would they divide the man in two, as Solomon directed the child to be divided, who was claimed by two women? I suppose the general government, as being paramount, would prevail. How are two legislatures to coincide with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent? For such is the definition of a legislature. There must be an external interference, not only in the collection of taxes, but in the judiciary. Was there ever such a thing in any court before? Great Britain never went so far in the Stamp Act. Poynings Law, the abhorrence of the Irish, never went so far. I never heard two supreme coordinate powers in one and the same country before. I cannot conceive how it can happen. It surpasses everything that I have read of concerning other governments, or that I conceive by the utmost exertion of my facilities.
Okay, so he's recognizing that there is maybe a contest of brightness, because he's just looking at them as the light that they're giving is equal. Now, you can have two spotlights, right? You can have four or five spotlights to, you know, emanate. Now, the tone or the focus of one, I'm just using this metaphorically, the tone or the focus of one, or maybe a group of the one, you know, along with the other one, could actually blend into, I don't know if you've ever seen this on stage, where they take all these different colors and using light, it creates white. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, actually, yeah.
Okay, so and when you take tones, adding in like a paint or what have you, and you take one color to another, it makes black. It doesn't mean that their focus, their tone, their intent are identical. They're not. As a matter of fact, it gets pointed out to them later that the focus of the federal government is only to do these things. Now, granted, he makes this point that he says, Mr. Mason has replied that they may interfere in the case of a poll tax. Actually, they couldn't, right? So here's, I say this all the time, but here is a case where history has actually proven that Mr. Mason was using hyperbole in saying that they could just interfere. Now, the federal government has interfered in all sorts of ways. There's no doubt that they've interfered well beyond, you know, those things that have been enumerated in the Constitution. But when it came to a poll tax, they knew that the states were not going to abide by, you know, this not having a poll tax for elections unless it was an amendment, because the states actually were pushing back. And so they actually had to pass an amendment, and I think it's, what is it, the 20... It was after woman suffrage. It was the racial suffrage, the woman suffrage, and then it was a poll tax, which I think was in the 60s. because many states were still basically forcing people that you had to pay your property tax if you wanted to vote. And so I find it surprising that that the states, the southern states, were doing that. And so that being said, you know, I don't. What ended up happening was it was a reality that people were not paying their property tax. And so the poll tax itself became a financial burden for somebody to basically participate in an election. It had been a practice for centuries, even before the Constitution, that poll taxes were levied. But clearly, Mr. Mason said that they would just do it. And that's not what happened. Okay, so anyway, he also points out that, you know, there's this coinciding transcendent, supreme, omnipotent, you know, conflict between these two legislatures. The objects that they are serving are completely different. They're supposed to be completely different. The federal government is not to be involved in education. They're not to be involved in all these things. And still to this day, we do find that, you know, they've functioned and they have operated with plenty of, I'll just say, I don't want to say, because I don't want to be callous, that it's not that taxation is hard for some people, but taxation for the legitimate government that we're supposed to have is not, we wouldn't have an income tax by the federal government if they were doing what they were supposed to do. Remember, and how many times have you heard me say this, that we don't really have a taxation problem at all. We have a spending problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so as long as we let them spend the money, then they're going to come back and say, you got to pay for that. You got to pay for this.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell you they're going to spend the money on this. That's why they put it in a budget and they continue to forecast. I mean, they're open with the fact that they're violating the Constitution by spending money on things they have no authority to do. This, folks, is right here telling you they're right out in the open committing fraud. Remember, that debt is not, you know, we're not obligated to pay that debt. That debt is fraud. So,
yeah.
So as we now dive into Mr. Pendleton, then kind of dives into this response with Mr. Grayson. Now, he comes back and talks a little bit more, explaining what he did, because I think that he just ran out of time in the previous day. So they let him wrap up. And he went a few pages in wrapping up. So Mr. Pendleton then kind of starts addressing some instances of things that he brought up. And one of those is common law. So let's dive into the common law comment. Here we go.
Okay. There will be deviations, even in our state legislatures, thus constituted. I say, and I hope to give no offense when I do, there have been some. I believe every gentleman will see that it is unconstitutional to condemn any man without a fair trial. Such a condemnation is repugnant to the principles of justice. It is contrary to the Constitution and the spirit of the common law. Look at the Bill of Rights. You find there that no man shall be condemned without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, that every man has a right to call for evidence in his favor, and above all, to a speedy trial by an impartial jury of the
vicinage, the local area.
Okay.
Like vicinity.
Of the vicinage without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty. These principles have not been attended to. An instance has been mentioned already where they have been in some degree violated.
Okay, so then he dives into this tax of the sovereigns. Okay, so, and actually he points out that Mr. Monroe earlier actually kind of complained about this as well. We skipped over him, but go ahead.
Okay. Gentlemen, Mr. Monroe has said that the power of direct taxation was unnecessary because the imposts and backlands would be abundantly sufficient to answer all federal purposes. If so, what are we disputing about? I asked the gentleman who made the observation in this committee if they believe that Congress will ever lay direct taxes if the other funds are sufficient. It will then remain a harmless power upon paper and do no injury. If it should be necessary, will gentlemen run the risk of the union by withholding it? I was sorry to hear the subjects of requisitions and taxations misinterpreted. The latter has been compared to taxation by Great Britain without our own consent. The two cases are by no means similar. The King of Great Britain has not the purse, though he holds the sword. He has no means of using the sword but by requisitions on those who hold the purse. He applied to the British Parliament, and they were pleased to trust him with our money. We declared, as we had a right, that we ought to be taxed by our own representatives, and that therefore their disposing of our money without our consent was unjust. Here requisitions are to be made by one body of our representatives to another. Why should this be the case, when they are both possessed of equal confidence, both chosen in the same manner and equally responsible to us?
Okay, so...
But we are told... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Thank you. So he kind of points out how in Britain, the importance of having this ability to direct tax, that the king didn't possess that, the parliament did. But I will tell you that the king could, at any point in time, you know, over-assert and just walk all over parliament. What ended up happening is because the kings have proven, or the monarchs, since parliament was created with the Magna Carta, the growth of a representative government in that body parliament became, I'll just say, you know, essential in this in a republican form of government. But even as we've gone through, because you probably remember how they talked about how even parliament was corrupt because it was really more of an aristocracy than a representative government, because they were just representing the people of affluence. So as we kind of look of, you know, even though right here Mr. Pendleton is saying the parliament has this, there have been way too many times, and even back then with the Revolutionary War, that they made the decision with the king basically, you know, saying, let's take it out of the American colonies. And the king, when we sought redress of grievances, the king said, no, we're going to take it out of your hide, instead of actually giving us representation. That one line right there, had he given us justice? I mean, I don't think people fathom this. If the king was not caught in a position where his, I'll just say his pride, got the best of him, because... You got to remember, before all this happened, the king kind of had a bad mental episode. I mean, he kind of went crazy. And so Parliament was kind of doing things on their own. And then when the king started coming back to, you know, his faculties, that, you know, we were petitioning him and saying, hey, come on, help, help. And instead of admitting that, you know, had he been there, maybe he would have been able to protect. He just let everything go the way it was. And he had no backbone. And had he actually... You know, I had this conversation, and let's think about this. Forgive me for going down this rat hole. But if you look at how much it was costing Britain, at this point in time, they needed money, right? Because that's why they were taxing us. They had an amount of debt that they needed a source of revenue, and so they thought that they'd take it out of our hide. Well, so they were given an option that either you give us representation, if you're going to tax us, and you give us representation, and then we will be paying your debt. But if you don't give us representation, then we will force you to spend a lot of money on war, when it's already been pointed out that he brought the Scots in, he brought the Germans, the Hessians in, he brought a lot of different mercenary forces that he paid good money for to come over here and fight. And he, in other words, he was racking up more debt just to try to keep us, instead of, you know, giving us representation. I'm just trying to place this so that people clearly see that, you know, King George was probably the biggest fool of the British monarchy ever. I mean, he had no business sense, because giving, just allowing us to have representation was, you know, would have been instrumental in preserving the great British Empire. And instead, it was the beginning of their, I'll just say, you know, their luster and their, you know, those things that they were trying to, you know, project, that they were this great, mighty, but good, wholesome empire. So anyway, I digress. So he goes on and talks more about the taxation regarding wars and so forth. So let's go ahead. Thank you.
But we are told that there will be a war between the two bodies equally, our representatives, and that the state government will be destroyed and consolidated into the general government. I stated before that this could not be so. The two governments act in different manners and for different purposes. The general government and great national concerns, in which we are interested in common with other members of the Union, the state legislature in our mere local concerns. Is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of bridges and roads? I think that they are still possessed of the highest powers. Our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property as Virginians are still in the hands of our state legislature. If they prove too feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of the general government for security. The true distinction is that the two governments are established for different purposes and act on different objects, so that, notwithstanding what the worthy gentleman said, I believe I am still correct, and insist that if each power is confined within its proper bounds and to its proper objects, an interference can never happen. Being for two different purposes, as long as they are limited to the different objects, they can no more clash than two parallel lines can meet. Both lay taxes, but for different purposes. The same officers may be used by both governments, which will prevent a number of inconveniences. If an invasion or insurrection or other misfortune should make it necessary for the general government to interpose, this will be for the general purposes of the Union and for the manifest interest of the states.
Okay, so one of the things that I think is really, really important that he talks about right here is towards the very end of what you were reading. I believe, because this goes into what I had been saying as we go through these arguments, as long as the Constitution is being followed as defined, they're not going to have problems. And this is what he says. I believe I am still correct and insist that if each power is confirmed within its proper bounds, or confined within its proper bounds, and to its proper objects, an interference can never happen between the federal government and the states. But instead, they said, hey, let us go, we can let you go, and, you know, we can just have a lot of fun. And they haven't been looking back for a couple centuries. So, anyway, now we jump down into the 13th, and actually we've kind of fly past that and go into the 14th. Now, Saturday the 14th is where they really dive into the militia and the armies and so forth. And what I need to do, so between probably now and, you know, before the end of this week or before we finish this, I need to go back through the 13th, the 14th, because I got to do a deep scrub. Because I remember they talked about the king controlling land, and how, you know, the whenever government can control land, they can take almost everything from you. So the reason why the federal government was so prohibited in being able to have any land other than that, those things for which they were, you know, enumerated within the Constitution, i.e. forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings, only those things, then, you know, government is, you know, going to basically be more dependent on the people and the states, because they can't possess land, they can't become rich. So anyway, I need to look for that, but we're getting into where they talk about martial law, the militia, and everything else. And so we're going into break at this point, and when we come back, we will dive into Saturday the 14th, where they dive deep into this warfare, the militia, and everything else. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so here we go. We're going to dive into the militia, and this is George Mason. Actually, we'll start off with Mr. Madison. Then we'll go into Mason, because Mason starts making assertions that the federal government is going to do things, and if they do those things or they don't do those things, then they would be in violation of the Constitution. So let's go ahead. Starting with Madison, of course. And I'm sure...
And I was muted.
Okay. There we go.
All right. Mr. Chairman, let me ask those who oppose this part of the system whether any alteration would not make it equally or more liable to objections. Would it be better to fix their compensations? Would not this produce inconveniences? What authorizes us to conclude that the value of coins will continue always the same? Would it be prudent to make them dependent on the state governments for their salaries, on those who watch them with jealous eyes and who consider them as encroaching not on the people but on themselves? But the worthy member supposes that Congress will fix their wages so low that only the rich can fill the offices of senators and representatives. Who are to appoint them? The rich? No, sir. The people are to choose them. If the members of the general government were to reduce their compensations to a trifle before the evil suggested could happen, the people could elect other members in their stead who would alter that regulation. The people do not choose them for their wealth. If the state legislators choose such men as senators, it does not influence the people at large in their election of representatives. They can choose those who have the most merit and least wealth. If Congress reduce their wages to a trifle, what shall prevent the states from giving a man of merit so much as will be an adequate compensation? I think the evil very remote, and if it were now to happen, the remedy is in our own hands and maybe by ourselves applied.
Okay, so I'm not sure if this actually kind of, you know, resonates, but it seems to me that many states brag about how little they pay their legislature, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Madison is actually talking about this. And they actually talked about the paradigm of that. Because if you're not compensating people fairly for their work, then nobody can actually afford to do the work. Does that make sense? And I know in Wyoming... When we look at the state legislators and what they get paid, and it just amazes me how everybody says, oh, well, those guys are fat pigs because they're making all that money, in contrast to what an actual lawyer who actually goes into court and actually, you know, has to defend or prosecute something that these men have written as the law of the land, and they're making bank compared to these guys.
Yeah, they don't get much.
That's right.
You really have to want to be there.
Well, I understand that. But I honestly think that there's this rule of thumb, a fair wage for the level of work you're being asked to do. And yeah. So because we have created and have become so stingy, why would somebody want to go into office to fix all of the problems? You're not paying him to do all of that, so he's just going to go there and make money the way he can. Because yeah. I've said this before, you won't make any money from lobbyists if you actually start shutting them down. In other words, there's no money in solving our governmental problems and holding government accountable. There's no money in it. And so the reason we're having problems is because these guys go in there and they do need assistance in getting reelected.
Mm-hmm.
See my point? Folks, you can't mm-hmm. have your bread buttered on all six sides. We need to really start changing our paradigm to say, if we want our representatives in a Republican form of government to be independent, then they need to be making a decent salary. You know how much judges make? Way more. way more. They're like, I think judges are probably one of the highest paid people in government. If you really look at what judges make in contrast to the governor. I don't know what your governor makes, but I would look at how much your judge makes, because those guys make they make a percentage off of the taxes. At least I know at the county level, and I believe your state and superior court, they may have more of a fixed, but there is a tie to you know how much money coming into the county that they get a stipend off of that. In other words, I know at the county level, they are, bar none, they are the highest paid person in the county in government, period. And so, and we're not even a judiciary form of government. Technically, if we have common law, the judges and so forth would really be just coming out of the crowds of the people. In common law courts, you don't have these high paid, falutin, you know, pompous judges with black robes. Anyway, so let's go down to the Mason comment regarding the militia and how this is the recipe of how they were going to abandon the militia. Now, keep in mind, as you're reading this and you're hearing this, folks, and this goes through your head, what he's saying is that they're going to do things that they don't have the authority to do. They're going to ignore their responsibilities, and that's how they're going to marginalize the militia. In other words, the Constitution doesn't create the marginalizing of the militia. It would be bad behavior by the federal government that would do this. The reason or how they, everything that he's talking about, all is directly associated to bad behavior of the government. It has nothing to do with the Constitution being the problem. And Mason gets away with this, and I don't think anybody really calls him out as we look, because they dare not upset these people. But anyway, let's go ahead. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, unless there be some restrictions on the power of calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, we may very easily see that it will produce dreadful oppressions. It is extremely unsafe without some alterations. It would be to use the militia to a very bad purpose if any disturbance happened in New Hampshire, to call them from Georgia. This would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of the militia and establish a standing army. I conceive the general government ought to have power over the militia, but it ought to have some bounds. If gentlemen say that the militia of a neighboring state is not sufficient, the government ought to have power to call forth those of other states, the most convenient and contiguous. But in this case, the consent of the state legislatures ought to be had. On real emergencies, this consent will never be denied, each state being concerned in the safety of the rest. This power may be restricted without any danger. I wish such an amendment as this, that the militia of any state should not be marched beyond the limits of the adjoining state, and if it be necessary to draw them from one end of the continent to the other, I wish such a check as the consent of the state legislature to be provided. Gentlemen may say that this would impede the government and that the state legislatures would counteract it by refusing their consent. This argument may be applied to all objections whatsoever. How is this compared to the British Constitution? Though the king may declare war, the Parliament has the means of carrying it on. It is not so here. Congress can do both. Were it not for that check in the British government, the monarch would be a despot. When a war is necessary for the benefit of the nation, the means of carrying it on are never denied. If any unjust requisition be made on Parliament, it will be, as it ought to be, refused. The same principle ought to be observed in our government. In times of real danger, the states will have the same enthusiasm in aiding the general government and granting its demands, which is seen in England when the king is engaged in a war apparently for the interest of the nation. This power is necessary, but we ought to guard against danger. If ever they attempt to harass and abuse the militia, they may abolish them and raise a standing army in their stead. There are various ways of destroying the militia. A standing army may be perpetually established in their stead. I abominate and detest the idea of government where there is a standing army. The militia may be here destroyed by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before, that is, by rendering them useless, by disarming them. Under their various pretenses, Congress may neglect to provide for arming and disciplining the militia, and the state governments cannot do it, for the Congress has an exclusive right to arm them, etc. Here is a line of division drawn between them, the state and the general governments. The power over the militia is divided between them. The national government has an exclusive right to provide for arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. The state governments have the power of appointing the officers and of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, if they should think proper to prescribe any. Should the national government wish to render the militia useless, they may neglect them and let them perish in order to have a pretense of establishing a standing army.
Okay, so I'll inject here. So at this point, he's making the assumption that they can just not even have a militia. The whole point of the standing army is to come from the states. The federal government has no ability to truly just create an army, which is what they've done. Because an army, just because the Constitution says, and let me pull it up, because understanding the Constitution and the language in it, so we're looking at Article 1, Section 8, and we're looking for the standing army. So, where does it talk about the standing army? Okay, to raise and support armies, but no appropriation for money to that use shall be for a longer than a term of 2 years. So, to raise and support armies. The only way they have the ability here, and let me, I know that there's a reference to standing, so let me see if I can find standing in the Constitution, exactly where that is. A-N-D-I-N-G. One, two, understand. So actually, the term standing army is actually not, quote-unquote, there in the Constitution. That is a phrase, that there should be no standing armies, is something that kind of responds to this. So, let me get back to what we're talking about. As we look at the point that they have the authority to raise and support armies, how is it that they are to raise the army? There's only one mechanism here, to call forth the militia. And that's how they form the army. To put them into the service of the federal government. There is no other way. They can't go and hire mercenaries. They can't just create, we're going to create an army, and we're just going to, anybody that wants to come work. Because when you look at the ATF, when you look at the FBI, those are standing armies. The concept of a standing army is a permanent army. And that's why they basically... They made it impossible by creating a 2-year financial allowance. In other words, the army needed to terminate after 2 years. Now, what if they have to fight a war? Then going into that, they would have to appropriate the money to extend for that. But the reality is we, the people, are the check of that to say, hey, the war is over. Shut down the army. Bring those guys home. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there is no other mechanism for them to actually start populating the Department of War or the Defense Department and creating a force for protecting the homeland. The army itself is not the Navy. The Navy is a standing security guard. That is their primary guard. And so I think that there were so many people that had army background back in these days, because who was Mason? Do you know who Mason was?
Mm-mm.
He was a colonel. That's not a naval rank. That's an army rank. And he was in the British Army. Colonel Mason, just like General Washington, right? So actually, it was Colonel Washington. There had never been a general promoted in America to be in the army. And that was a standing army that the king had. He was hiring people from all over the place. He wasn't calling forth a militia. This design is very specific. It requires that they have to fund, or they have to basically staff the war fighter has to come out of the militia. No other way. This concept of them being able to do this is just, it boggles my mind and how they present this stuff. And unfortunately, the way they're debating, it's not like they go point by point. What ends up happening, and this is why they were constantly migrating, you know, and regurgitating the same arguments constantly throughout the debates, because they were their little pet peeves and they got away with it. Academically, you know, when you talk about a point, you don't go on to the next point until you've exhausted the clarity of that point. So you're focused on one, like a standing army and the funding of an army and the sourcing of the army. That's the one point that should be basically discussed academically, so before anybody could move on to what the next point that Mason talks about, like martial law, like the deployment thereof, and so forth. So each of those are literally different points that need to be addressed academically. But they didn't debate that way. So that's why I think when people read and they look at the way they address things, the anti-federalists got away with making all sorts of ambiguous assertions that were really unfounded. And as a matter of fact, I think had they had a more mature level of academic standards, they could have easily said, you know, oh, sit down, this person's breaking the rules, the policies of what we agreed, how we were going to debate, by trying to go back to something else. And so the chair, you know, would have actually had to cut people off as they sit down. You're violating the policy. You keep on bringing up something that has been resolved. So anyway, as we look at this next point, this is something that was kind of new that we just brought up next year. So go ahead. Actually, last year.
No man has a greater.
Go ahead. It's 2024. That's why the 24 is there. So this was identified, gotcha. And we brought this forward last year. Go ahead.
Okay. No man has a greater regard for the military gentlemen than I have. I admire their intrepidity, perseverance, and valor. But when once a standing army is established in any country, the people lose their liberty. When against a regular and disciplined army, what's that word?
Yeomanry
are the only defense. Yeomanry, unskillful and unarmed, what chance is there for preserving freedom? Give me leave to recur to the page of history to warn you of your present danger. Recollect the history of most nations of the world. What havoc, desolation, and destruction have been perpetuated by standing armies. An instance within the memory of some of this house will show us how our militia may be destroyed. 40 years ago, when the resolution of enslaving America was formed in Great Britain, the British Parliament was advised by an artful man who was governor of Pennsylvania to disarm the people, that it was the best and most effectual way to enslave them, but that they should not do it openly, but weaken them and let them sink gradually by totally disusing and neglecting the militia. Here Mr. Mason quoted sundry passages to this effect. This was a most iniquitous project. Why should we not provide against the danger of having our militia, our real and natural strength, destroyed? The general government ought at the same time to have some such power, but we need not give them power to abolish our militia. If they neglect to arm them and prescribe proper discipline, they will be of no use. I am not acquainted with the military profession. I beg to be excused for any errors I may commit with respect to it. But I stand on the general principles of freedom, whereon I dare to meet anyone. I wish that in case the general government should neglect to arm and discipline the militia, there should be an express declaration that the state governments might arm and discipline them. With this single exception, I would agree to this part, as I am conscious the government ought to have the power.
Okay, so here he's bringing up a point that the states don't have a militia without the Constitution, and that's not true. The Constitution sets the standard that if the federal government or if this general government had to prosecute an action to suppress an insurrection or to repel an invasion, they would have the authority to call forth the militia for that purpose or to execute the laws of the Union for that purpose and that purpose alone. They could not create an army. I can't make this any clearer, but he keeps rambling, and you know, again, this is a long oration where he gets away with, you know, bringing and twisting and folding, and this is why when many people look, because everything that the federal government has done regarding the militia out the gate, they violated it. Even with Washington, when we get into the Whiskey Rebellion, Congress, it's their job, per the Constitution, to call forth the militia. Because Washington wasn't ready, and Congress didn't want to have to come back into session just to give the president, you know, just to call forth the militia for the president because he's now ready. Well, okay, so, you know, they basically passed a law that allowed the president to call them. Well, they didn't have that authority. Only Congress could do it. And so, you know, there are consequences. If the president's not ready, then, you know, the president either has to wait till the session's over, because what's the difference? I think when they called forth the militia, if you actually look at the time frame, Congress was in session. Because when Congress is out of session, most people aren't involved in protests. They're not involved, you know, with the whiskey protest or war or anything else. They're all working in their fields because it's harvest time. They've got all the food or all the things that are coming in that they got to take care of before the winter. And then they hunker down for the winter. Congress then comes back into session, I believe somewhere in February, January, maybe March, whenever it is, but they come back. And that's when they call forth the militia to go into Pennsylvania. They didn't inconvenience anybody back in those days. And so I just didn't understand why, other than this over respect. In other words, they were extending too much respect and latitude to the president of the United States by saying, well, we'll go ahead and do this for you because you're almost a demigod. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens. That's what happens when people become too large, too big for their shoes, too big for their head, whatever you want to call it. You know, and we see this all the time today in politicians. Bill Clinton, Obama, Trump. I mean, these guys have egos. Anyway, let's keep going. Go ahead for the next paragraph.
Okay. They may effect the destruction of the militia by rendering the service odious to the people themselves, by harassing them from one end of the continent to the other, and by keeping them under martial law. The English Parliament never passed a mutiny bill but for 1 year. This is necessary, for otherwise the soldiers would be on the same footing with the officers, and the army would be dissolved. One mutiny bill has been here in force since the revolution. I humbly conceive there is extreme danger of establishing cruel martial regulations. If at any time our rulers should have unjust and iniquitous designs against our liberties, and should wish to establish a standing army, the first attempt would be to render the service and use of militia odious to the people themselves, subjecting them to unnecessary severity of discipline in time of peace, confining them under martial law, and disgusting them so much as to make them cry out, "Give us a standing army." I would wish to have some check to exclude this danger, as that the militia should never be subject to martial law but in time of war. I consider and fear the natural propensity of rulers to oppress the people. I wish only to prevent them from doing evil. By these amendments I would give necessary powers, but no unnecessary power. If the clause stands as it is now, it will take from the state legislatures what divine providence has given to every individual, the means of self-defense. Unless it be moderated, in some degree, it will ruin us and introduce a standing army.
Okay, so they can't just give them a standing army. What would it require for a standing army to be created? So we talked about Mason making it a point that they would meddle with the poll tax in elections. Well, what did it actually require for them to actually meddle with the poll tax? An amendment. The only way that the federal government could actually create and possess a permanent army that they have full control over, instead of a army that they have on lend or on loan from the states to help basically do their job in repelling invasions, suppressing insurrections, or executing the laws, because that's all the army is to do. So the only way that they could do this is an amendment. And when they created the Dick Act and they started playing around with how the militia was going to be maintained moving forward, they obliterated the militia. They did create a standing army, and they did it without an amendment, and therefore they are in violation of the Constitution. It's that simple. What Mason is saying here is just, to me, it's grandstanding. That's all he's doing, because he wanted a Bill of Rights. He wanted something that would make, you know, because he created this thing called the Bill of Rights for Virginia, and it was something that would, you know, make him famous throughout the annals of history. And I think that the same thing with the Bill of Rights. Had he been able to charge forward in creating a Bill of Rights, he would also, too, be remembered. Thank you so much, Tammy, for joining us. So, folks, when we come back tomorrow, we're going to actually dive into, and if you didn't hear it, Tammy actually said you're welcome. she was fading out there. But anyway, we'll dive into this tomorrow, where Madison actually starts refuting all of this. And he actually points out that these things are all protected in the Constitution. They can't do those things. And that's why we go through the ratification debates. I'm Jerry Mobley. We're coming to the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.